Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here, of course. Thanks for the opportunity to talk and for tolerating this title. Great. So actually, some of the themes that Leonardo touched upon in his talk set me up very nicely. And so let me start off with a kind of teaser puzzle. So we know that the Lagrangian n equals 4 Supriangulos theory that we know and love is dual to string theory in ABS 5 times S5. But from the perspective of n equals 4 conformal data, dimensions, OP coefficients, and so on, why is the S5 necessary? If I don't let you use the fact that there's a Lagrangian, it's not obvious. The S5 KK modes furnish a tower of protected superconformal multiplets with primaries 02, 03, 04, and so on, with protected dimensions. And 02 is in the stress tensor multiplet, and that's the one required by superconformal symmetry, but the higher ones are not. So is the familiar n equals 4 Supriangulos theory the unique n equals 4 4D SCFT? Is one question, one way you can phrase this little puzzle. And gravitationally, you can ask if the 5D maximal gauge supergravity, which has a pure ADS5 vacuum, has a UV completion. All the fully controlled examples of ADS-CFT involve large, that is to say, ADS-scale positive curvatures. Here's a set that we are all familiar with. And for good reason, these are easier to construct in supergravity. So these transverse manifolds imply towers of light operators in the dual CFTs, but the landscape presumably is much richer than this, and so there's a set of questions that arise naturally when you ask what is possible, some of which Leonardo essentially already said. So do we need large extra dimensions for some reason, or is this just the kind of supergravity lamppost effect that I just described? What are the statistics of these ADS times small solutions within the landscape, if they exist? And from the pure CFT point of view, what are the bootstrap constraints that you might try to impose on the low energy effective field theory to constrain it? So by now there's a long-standing story about how ADS scale bulk locality emerges from CFT, which can be summarized as saying that if you have a large NCFT with a large higher spin gap, then you have a local ADS bulk. But there's still a question about in what dimension the bulk is local. And in terms of CFT data, this is the question about how sparse the low spin CFT spectrum is, not a statement about whether there are high spin operators of spin 4, say, or above. Sparseness of the low spin spectrum and the gap to the higher spin sector are not the same thing. And indeed, bulk duals would differ in terms of the number of dimensions in which they are local, depending on the answer to this question. Sorry? I mean, that is one question. When you say that's the question, you mean?
When you have extra dimensions, you have massive spin 2.
Yes. It's true. That is included in this sparseness question. Yeah. Thanks. So if you define d as the number of large, that is to say, ADS size bulk dimensions, you can ask how D appears in the 1 over n expansion of the dual CFT, and that's the kind of question that I'll try to address today. And the tool that I will try to use is that of loop amplitudes in ADS. So why do ADS loops have anything to do with this question? Well, in ADS CFT, we're often concerned with sequences of CFTs that admit a large n limit, and what's obvious is that these consistency conditions, like crossing symmetry, must be satisfied order by order in this 1 over n expansion, assuming a nice expansion around infinite n. What's less obvious from a CFT point of view, but which is obvious from the bulk, is that different orders in 1 over n are related. So here's just a picture of some one-loop correction to a bulk three-point coupling. You know, as field theory, it's obvious that this corrects the bulk coupling, but in terms of the CFT, this is a, say, 1 over n cubed correction to the leading 1 over n three-point function, and it's fixed, it's cubic, in the leading 1 over n coupling. Right, so that's a statement about the 1 over n relation between different terms. And so, indeed, modular details that are important, of course, all orders are fixed by planar CFT data in this kind of way. So if we look at four-point functions which depend on kinematics, we get extra power, just like we do when we solve crossing symmetry for OPE coefficients. And loop amplitudes can see extra dimensions in the sense that everything runs in loops. If you look at a fixed number of classical correlators in the bulk, you probably won't be able to tell if there are extra dimensions because there exist consistent truncations where you throw everything away. But at loop level, everything runs in the loops. So if you can cut these diagrams open, you can hope to see the extra dimensions directly as some kinematic behavior of these amplitudes. So trying to get to this point would involve understanding what it means to cut an amplitude in more detail, and then you can consider taking different kinematic limits where you extract this kind of information about the number of dimensions. So cutting amplitudes and constructing them in terms of entre lower point amplitudes is exactly the idea behind unitarity methods for ordinary amplitudes, and so I've spent a fair amount of work trying to understand unitarity methods for radius amplitudes, and that's part of what I'll discuss. So the idea is to leverage loop amplitudes to probe theory space. So here, if we put the landscape in our crosshairs, there's a nice little picture you can draw. And so that's the philosophy behind this talk. Okay. And so one of the lessons that I'll try to impart is that if we want to discover, so to speak, string theory by these kinds of bootstrap arguments, it's important to look at the intermediate part of the spectrum. So black holes are up here. KK modes on large manifolds are down here. And in here you have things like putative string states and other objects that are not black hole microstates. And they are sensitive to these stringy aspects of string theory. So today I'll focus on the emergence of extra dimensions from properties of the spectrum in this range. And this will lead us to some statement about the OPE between string scale, that is to say, operators of dimension much greater than 1 but much less than c, degrees of freedom. So there's going to be some universal property of that OPE, which I'll extract from thinking about loop amplitudes. Part of it will be conjectural, and we'll discuss that in turn. Okay, so I'll talk about these issues in this rough order. This is based on this set of papers. So there's a paper from a few years ago, which will sort of set the foundation for part one, which was then developed further in this paper and this paper. Then in this paper with Fernando Aldai, we started looking at this question about the landscape, and then there's some work in progress with Dalemil and Leonardo, which just inform some of my perspective about this, but I have no results to announce, but that hopefully will happen in the future. So several of these people are here. So obviously David and Leonardo are here. David Meltzer and Alec Sivaramakrishnan are also in the audience, so is Jin Yu Liu. Good. Okay, so just some notation first. These are my conventions for S and T channel, and I'll call amplitudes, aka correlators A, where I just strip off this prefactor. Okay. So if you have some bulk amplitude or some CFT correlator of some scalar phi, if you look at the disconnected piece, it has an expansion in these double trace composite operators. These, in mean field theory, that is to say, at the disconnected order, have exactly their engineering dimensions. The anomalous dimensions are zero. And just to introduce some slight notation that we'll use, this is meant to be a conformal block, and just in terms of symbols, I'm going to call conformal blocks G, where here I've pictured them in the S channel, and this P naught is the squared OPE coefficient coming from this mean field theory expansion of this Witten diagram. So it's a sum over spins and a sum over this twist index N. Now, at tree level in the bulk, you have, for example, for an exchange diagram, a single trace exchange, and then corrections to these double trace data coming from the same diagram. So this part of the OPE involves imparting an anomalous dimension to these double trace operators. And so that anomalous dimension, in general, has an expansion in 1 over C. The tree level piece here, gamma 1, is what is determined by this diagram. And that's fixed essentially by the single trace data. You see that there are cubic vertices which map to the three-point couplings to this operator O, and so modulo low spin subtleties, that just fixes gamma 1. And gamma 2 is the one loop correction to this anomalous dimension, and my point is that it's fixed by the tree level data, and the question is how. So the unitarity methods are designed to build loop amplitudes from lower order on-trail amplitudes. Here's a picture of the optical theorem. Right, it buys you an order in perturbation theory. Now in ADS, there's no S matrix, but we compute CFT correlators instead if the bulk fields have the appropriate boundary condition. And so we can try to phrase this kind of thing in CFT language. So that was what we did originally in late 2016. We developed a boundary-based unitarity method for these amplitudes. And more recently, we've developed a bulk method, and the two agree. And I'll just sort of flash what these things look like without getting too much into the weeds. So before I do that, there's been a handful of papers about ADS loops. Some earlier papers are listed here. Several of the diagrams that we'll see were drawn in these papers, but I think now we've developed a more precise understanding of what it means to cut and glue. And there's been a sort of proliferation of loop papers in the past few years from different types of perspectives. And I've tried to categorize them in the right way. So I'll mostly be talking about these works, of course. And there's also a paper by Ponomarev, which came out earlier this year, which has some similar ideas to what we discuss here. So the boundary unitarity method in one slide. So by now, we hopefully all know that CFT correlators can be reconstructed from their double discontinuity. There's a dispersion relation which schematically looks like this. There's some kernel against which you integrate the double discontinuity, and you reconstruct the correlator. Now I'm skipping some details, and indeed, originally, the Lorentzian inversion formula was not phrased in this way. But for the sake of this discussion, all I need is this fact that the double discontinuity essentially contains all of the information about the correlator. For identical scalar external operators, if you take the double discontinuity of a single T-channel conformal block, say, and you take this discontinuity in the T-channel, then you just get the block back times this sine squared factor. Okay. So remember, phi is the external operator. So there are some obvious features of this result. This annihilates double trace operators with vanishing anomalous dimension. Indeed, it's quadratic in their anomalous dimension. So in the 1 over C expansion, the one loop amplitude has a piece which comes from summing over double traces, which is quadratic in the tree level anomalous dimension. But the one loop anomalous dimension does not appear because double discontinuity kills it. So in this sense, you can see that the OPE data you would extract via the dispersion relation for this object is fixed by the right-hand side, which just depends on tree-level data. Okay, so in the bulk, what we want to do is find define operations which we can recognize as cutting, and then identify these two unitarity methods as best we can. Okay, so I'll be pretty schematic here. There's some suggestion that you would try to cut the diagram by gluing trees like this, and that's the concept that we make precise. So you can do this by using various ADS propagator identities and conformal machinery. So one key point is that because this internal propagator is off-shell, you don't just glue two on-shell tree-level diagrams, but you actually glue a continuum's worth of tree-level diagrams. The reverse statement here is that if you have a bulk-to-bulk propagator, there's something called the split representation, which I've pictured here. You write it as a product of two bulk-to-boundary propagators, integrated over the boundary point, and integrated over the principal series for the dimensions of these two legs. Okay. So inserting this inside of a loop amplitude like that, you have some kinematic factors from the ADS integrals, and we can define a cut operator as picking up just this pole in the integrand, which puts these legs back to their physical value of the original operator propagating on that leg. For this reason, we call this the single trace pole, and you can think of this as a way to define what it means to put these legs on shell.
Just so I understand, in particular, yep. this would be robust against, say, supersymmetry cancellations in the loop. That might be special to certain theories.
Yes. I think there's probably a more right. Mm-hmm. So here I'm doing this from a very kind of bottom-up individual diagram perspective. In supersymmetric cases, you might imagine there's a more efficient way to compute. But so far I'm.
No, I was just worrying about the opposite, that there would be cancellations, and you wouldn't see the full glory of the spectrum because it would be canceling out.
I think that would only help you. That could be, though. I mean, ultimately, when you use this kind of spectral representation, the physical information, in some sense, is contained in just certain pieces of the integrand. So if supersymmetry makes that simpler, then that's fine.
So like the effect of central charge gets canceled in supersymmetry theory if you just add it up, but individual terms are telling you what the actual dimensionality is, and so I'm just checking that you're getting the latter, not the
same. Yeah, I would say once you account for everything, you would get the latter. Yeah, sure. Okay, so this operation that implements a cut, you put the internal legs on shell by picking up this special pole, and in the CFT, you can show that this corresponds to isolating the respective double trace operators in the conformal partial wave expansion. So if you have a diagram like this, you can imagine trying to cut it internally or externally. And so this, the claim is that the double discontinuity, which kills the external double trace operators, is this internal cut operator for a box diagram like this. So we have this D-disc on the one hand, and this sort of cut operation of picking up this single pole in spectral space on the other, and these at one loop are the same. For non-1 PI diagrams, the double discontinuities are weighted sum of these cuts. You can sort of picture that, but this is the moral point. Okay. So one comment is that when you start gluing these diagrams, 6J symbols for the conformal group appear very naturally. So if I try to decompose a diagram like this in this T channel, if I write it as a gluing of two S channel trees, then for each one, I can manipulate my way toward using crossing to swap it into a T-channel tree, and then eventually get to a conformal partial wave expansion. And with every such crossing transformation, I pick up a 6J symbol. So in this sense, 6J symbols are ADS ladder kernels, in that every time I add a rung, I have to do crossing one more time to go to the cross channel. The equals sign is in quotes because you're gluing together diagrams where the internal legs are off shell, but morally, this is one interesting role for the 6J symbol in the context of computing Witten diagrams. So we applied this prescription to some diagrams and some non-1 PI diagrams, and that can all be found in the paper. So the bulk and boundary prescriptions are equivalent. This can be explained mostly with pictures. So what we want to do is adapt this boundary unitarity method to reconstruct individual diagrams, whereas what I described before to you gives the full crossing symmetric amplitude. But this is easy to do. So if you imagine taking the tree-level anomalous dimension and writing it as a contribution from ST and U channel tree-level diagrams, then each term in this expansion, when you plug this in and expand, corresponds to the bulk gluing of the respective diagrams in those channels. So for example, if you plug in the T channel anomalous dimension from the phi cube theory, then this corresponds to constructing this amplitude, or rather the double discontinuity of this amplitude, by cutting in the way that I just described before. So likewise, if you sort of turn the diagrams and glue them in the S-channel instead, you get the same double discontinuity by using the formula I had before, where you use the S-channel contribution to the anomalous dimension. And likewise for this sort of mixed case. And so in that way, you're reconstructing these diagrams by cutting. It can also say that you can contract this diagram to a quartic vertex, and on the CFT side, that corresponds just to substituting a phi to the fourth anomalous dimension for one of the phi cubed ones. So it's a very clean map. Okay. Good. So that's some of the technology. Now let's move on to the landscaping. There have been attempts to construct ADS times small solutions in string theory. Here is a set of four sort of representative cases. And now, these constructions involve various assumptions or approximations, which is, as it must be, it should be hard to construct these solutions where the curvatures in some area are small. And I'm not trying to analyze these solutions. The arguments may well be correct, and I respect these papers. What I'm trying to do is just give a different approach to this question in the bootstrap, where we can hope to say things rigorously from a different perspective. Was that? All right. So,
can you go back to?
Yeah, please. Yeah.
So let me just say that the action of localized sources is in there, and the curvature that you alluded to, you're looking for a hierarchy, not the pure gravity story where if there's a desert, you're looking for a hierarchy here. So it's
right.
Easier for that reason. But except that.
Yeah, even something like a a partial hierarchy, you know, so a situation where you have ADS times something large times something small with curvature, that would already be interesting and different from the canonical cases, right? So even those intermediate cases, I would be happy to try to establish those rigorously. I mean, these papers do something, harder, in that the solutions that you constructed have no large extra dimensions. They're all small.
Yeah, but just right. Small compared to the ADS.
Yes, yeah. Indeed. Mm-hmm. Okay, so you might ask, this question seems tailor-made for the bootstrap, why is it hard? Well, here are four things that come to mind. The first is what I'd call the ADS effective field theory problem, which is that if you write down some effective field theory in ADS, then at least order by order in 1 over n crossing is satisfied by way of the GKPW dictionary. And so you can't just use crossing symmetry in the ordinary way to try to constrain the landscape that way. Okay. The second is that non-perturbative constraints in n may not apply in 1 over n perturbation theory. So sometimes constraints on the Regé growth of a correlator are used to derive things like sum rules. And if you try to expand this in 1 over n, it is not valid. This recent paper that Leonardo briefly alluded to by Panadonis, Silva, and Dzhuboyedov has some interesting sum rule which kind of gets around this. I'd be happy to talk about that, but I don't have the space right now. The third point is that large n competes with approximate solutions of crossing, as Leonardo described before. Here's a plot from this paper. On the x-axis is the central charge, on the y-axis is the lightest dimension in the 2D CFT divided by C. The asymptotic 9.08 is this dotted line, and you can see that as C increases, these dots, these colored dots, are iterations of the numerics where the sort of truncation is taken to be larger and larger, and therefore the approximation is better and better to the full modular invariance equations. And you can see that as you increase the central charge, the spread increases. Right, this is reflecting the fact that at large C, it's harder to do these kinds of numerics. In this context, it's been nailed down, but still, there is this large N problem more generally. And finally, I'd just cite what I like to call the asymptoticity problem, which is really something that Simeon Hellerman described in this paper, this talk he gave this summer. This is the idea that even if you can establish results in 1 over N perturbation theory, a lot of what we are concerned about in the landscape pertains to solutions which are at large but finite n, and then these techniques do not even help you there at all. Okay, so it's hard to get away from perturbation theory, but when we try to describe the landscape, that's, depending on your exact question, often what we want to do. Okay, and then you really have to work non-perturbatively. Okay, so now I'll present a sum rule for D in terms of the planar OPE data, and the argument is simple. So if you consider a d-dimensional two-derivative theory of gravity, consider some four-point amplitude, it has some expansion in G Newton. Now suppose there exists an ADS times M solution where the radius of this manifold M is of the same order as LADS. Okay, so these are both large in the nomenclature I've been using so far. This is a safe regime for the effective field theory of this two-derivative theory. So if you write this amplitude in terms of a d plus 1 dimensional Newton's constant just by dividing out by the volume of m and look at the high energy limit, then by dimensional analysis it has to take this form, where I've rewritten g Newton in terms of 1 over c using the holographic dictionary. Now, interestingly, capital D appears here in the one loop term, and so the goal is to match this to the flat space limit of a CFT correlator in d dimensions. Now, if you have a correlator, you can match in the flat space limit the partial wave coefficients to those of the flat space amplitude. So one loop is going to be some set of coefficients times the block times these mean field theory OP coefficients, and in the limit, this combination here turns over to the partial waves of the flat space amplitude. So there is a known dictionary between the momentum in the flat space amplitude on the one hand and the twist of the operators in the sum on the other, indexed by this little n, and the relation is this here. This is articulated nicely in this Fitzpatrick et al. Paper. And so recalling the previous formula, where we have this factor, this matching yields the relation between little n to this power on the one hand, and the asymptotic scaling of these coefficients in the one-loop correlator on the other. So the power comes from determining the one-loop coefficients in terms of the planar data via unitarity. So the general result for these coefficients is as follows. So let me explain this. So these, you want to think of all these contributions as coming from one-loop diagrams where you have O's on the internal lines that you're imagining cutting. Okay. So an operator O with a generic dimension with respect to that of phi contributes just with the squared OP coefficient times this sine factor from the double discontinuity. Okay. If you have an operator O which is degenerate with phi modulo integers, then this term turns into this term, and you have a squared anomalous dimension appearing. And the brackets indicate that because there's some mixing, you have to do some averaging to extract that. And finally, this is just the sum over the single trace density of states, O, for these new operators, O, running in the intermediate channel. So given this expression, the scaling at large ln has to match here, and this is the sum rule for D in terms of the planar OPE data. So this is positive definite term by term, so if you just have limited information about this data, you can still bound D from below. And it's important to note that trees are insensitive to D. So if we go back to this formula, you see that capital D does not appear. And that's just as well because consistent truncations exist. And as I said before, you can just think of those as living in the ADS D plus one dimensional spacetime. So that's good. So just to break this formula down a little bit, what does it imply? If we have a power law density of non-degenerate single trace operators, then performing this sum in the regime where the wave function is localized in the bulk, which is large little n of order the dimension of O, you get that the scaling goes like n to the 2 little d plus x minus 1, and you infer from the sum rule that capital D is just d plus 1 plus x. So this scaling of generic single trace operators gives you x large extra dimensions. Okay. This isn't so surprising or necessarily that interesting. I think you get more mileage when you start to look at degenerate operators. Okay, so now imagine you have some tower of degenerate operators, modulo integers, with phi. For example, in n equals 4 super Young Mills, you have this tower I discussed before. Now, if there's a cubic coupling, then you have a diagram like this in the bulk, and by crossing, this gives a contribution to the anomalous dimension of these phi-phi operators being exchanged in the S-channel, right? And this coupling, or this anomalous dimension, rather, is proportional to the square of this OP coefficient phi pp. You can compute at large little n how this thing behaves. It goes like a power of n times this asymptotic OP coefficient. That's interesting. Now, you can ask, how does this OP coefficient behave? Well, if we parameterize it like so, then the sum rule implies that you grow 1 plus alpha extra dimensions. So in familiar cases, the OPE coefficient is exactly linear, that is to say alpha is 0. For the stress tensor, for example, this is just due to a Ward identity. So if we take a tower of operators in rank p symmetric traceless representations of SON, you get d plus n plus alpha, and if alpha were 0, you would just recover the ADS times sphere convectifications in which you should regard these fields as being KK modes. So this suggests, actually, that more generally there's some OP universality going on, but this OP coefficient should be linear. And so indeed that is a statement that I want to make. So for single trace operators, phi and phi p, where delta phi is much less than the gap, and delta p is proportional to some parameter p, which is becoming large, but not too large, less than some power of the central charge, this planar OP coefficient has linear asymptotics in p. By planar OP coefficient, I mean take large C, look at the leading order OP coefficient in the planar theory. What is the coefficient scale as? So some comments on this result. So phi p here can be a KK mode or a massive string mode. In that sense, this is a statement about the string-string OPE. This is not ETH, heavy, heavy, light, or large charge. Here, the central charge is the largest parameter in the game, and the heavy operator is not too heavy. This is the closest you can get to making these statements in a planar CFT in the regime where the 1 over C expansion still applies. Now, there's a lot of evidence for this. The correlators of these KK modes and these spherical compactifications obey this linearity. If you look at not just these protected cases, but unprotected correlators involving strings in ADS5, still to heavy operators and n equals 4 super young males, you also find this linearity. And I don't, there's a lot of literature, I don't think this has been observed before. It would be nice to prove it. We gave a sketch of how to do this using WorldSheet techniques, but it's very much a sketch indeed. So let us now turn the philosophy around. This is more of a target for the future. If you assume that the bulk has a string or M theory dual, where the dimension is bounded above by the critical dimension, say, of string theory in 10D, what does this imply about the spectrum of planar CFTs? Well, the logic is that if you have too many single trace operators, then you'll get too many dimensions emerging. So the density of states in this regime where the dimensions are heavy is bounded above by some power which depends on the space-time dimension. And that power depends on whether you have string theory or M theory in the bulk. Likewise, if you have some operators which furnish a sequence of irreducible representations of a global symmetry with asymptotics scaling some power of p, then this kind of inequality bounds that power. It would be really interesting to prove these bounds from CFT if they're true, and to understand, if so, why they're true. This is not at all obvious to me that, say, in a 4D CFT with a critical or subcritical string dual, you can't have single trace operators growing faster than delta to the fourth. That is something that would be nice to prove. So finally, there are some speculations that one can make about what exactly it takes to construct a local ADS dual with capital D equals D plus 1. You might wonder whether symmetries are playing some role in growing the extra dimensions for you. In view of time, I won't say so much about this. This really generalizes an argument of Eva and Joe. And there have been recent conjectures that D equals D plus 1 is not possible by this group. The jury is certainly still out on that. And if you believe some of these ADS times small constructions that I cited earlier, then the conjecture is wrong. So let's see, and hopefully the bootstrap can say something definitively one way or another. So this is what we discussed, the unitarity methods, their use in probing extra dimensions, and this interesting feature that seems to be true about the OPE in planar CFTs. And then, of course, there are various directions. Here are some of them, and I'll stop there. Thanks.
Beautiful talk, and there's something that I think is crucial to stress about the connection to the landscape, which I don't think is controversial for those who have thought about it, but is crucial. So if there are these ADS and DS solutions that are part of a landscape, you know, I think Raphael coined the term and Joe coined the term discrete Joom, then in the absence of some extra special symmetry, like maybe a lot of supersymmetry or something, the ADS part of that decays almost instantly. It decays in a sort of ADS time scale because there's all that volume at infinity and the bubbles just come in. And I think Dan Harlow wrote one of the papers on this. It's a well-known thing. And so the prediction of the landscape solutions is not that there's a stable ADS solution and hence a CFT. Let me say one more thing, okay. The irony related to this is that the DS part of this putative landscape is much more stable because it takes, you know, it's an exponentially long-lived. There is no asymptotic boundary, which is both a bug and a feature in terms of our theoretical understanding of things. But in this regard, it's actually quite a feature because it makes the lifetime exponentially long. I totally agree that if there's a more specific question about the supersymmetric case, which I said initially in my comment, but the landscape idea and application is aimed at, you know, real physics ultimately, and so the extra supersymmetry doesn't pertain in that context. So I think that's why I started to say I don't think any of this is controversial, but I think it's worth stressing, if that makes sense.
Yes. I think that So it's tough to access the discrete room for this this asymptoticity issue that I sort of discussed before, using methods that I'm familiar with, but it seems like worth, nevertheless, investigating in the generic context of Bootstrap whether the kinds of CFTs with the sparseness properties described here exist, even if the expectation from the landscape is that they might not exist due to the instabilities you mentioned. So that could, I mean, perhaps this would, you know, end up fracturing the landscape even further into, if these, you know, situations where there's a decay and situations where for some reason there's not, whether due to supersymmetry or some other mechanism. And so if we could discover any part of this, that would be neat.
So there are constructions of n equals 1 ADS4 vacuum that really are supposed to be asymptotic. So for large n, everything should be under control. So those fall squarely within this kind of investigations.
Yes, I agree, as we've been discussing. And so I think, for instance, this one is a sequence of such theories, which moreover has no supersymmetry. So whether that makes it more or less attractive depends on taste.
Number three, for example. Number three is.
There have been many others, by the way, especially. I don't know, in the past 5 years. This is just a sample, but I think it's representative.
Okay. Let me just say that one example of ADS compactification with small internal space comes from standard model. If you compactize standard model on a small circle, there is a vacuum like that, which depends only on the very IR physics. So if you manage to, by conformal bootstrap, exclude CFTs like that, that would be very interesting because that would indicate that either there are extra particles, very light particles in the standard model, or will prove that standard model is metastable state, which we expect because 4D vacuum is the sitter, but that would be proved without relying on any prejudices about the sitter being metastable or stable. So.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I would hesitate to use arguments like that to really make hard conclusions about the standard model because of the differences between these conformal techniques and the non-conformality of the standard model. So one should make sure that the approximation is controlled.
No, if you compactify standard model on a circle, there is a ADS3 crosses 1 vacuum, mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. which corresponds, if it's a stable compactification, that would correspond to some dual conformal theory. And the circle is very small.
That's the part I just would want to understand better, but I think that's yes, I take your point. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So, when you were talking about these theories with a gap, you used the word necessary. Maybe it's more like sufficient is a good word, right? Like, I mean, you could have some interesting particle physics or something, or say you had large N QCD in the bulk, then you would have higher spin hadrons and things, right? And maybe those wouldn't quite fit into the formalism that you're talking about, but...
Yes. I agree.
Okay.
I agree. I think that there's some... I mean, you could characterize a lot of the work that's happened in the past decade since HPPS is trying to understand whether that is sufficient and for what.
I think sufficient is kind of what they argued. They didn't argue necessary. I mean, they didn't rigorously argue sufficient either, but one could imagine taking what they said and turning it into a rigorous sufficiency argument. But the assumption seemed too strong to rule out all the sorts of interesting things that could be happening in the bulk.
Yeah, for sure. It's just trying. It's not trying to account for everything. Yeah. I just put it that way. Yeah.
Any further questions? Well, if they're not, let's thank Gary again.